get the show on the road. We'll call the House Finance Department of Law Budget Subcommittee to order. And today's Tuesday, January 29th, approximately 10:30 a.m. Members present are Representatives Gruenberg, Josephson, myself, Representative Holmes, Representative Ledoux, and Representative Keller. Hopefully we'll be joined by a few others in a few moments. Today we're going to hear a departmental overview from the Attorney General, Michael Garrity. Mr. Attorney General, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here this morning to present an overview of our department. I've got some deputies and others with me who may supplement what I have to say or offer additional details. But just as an overview,
Mr. Attorney General, I'd just like to say we've been joined by Representative Pruitt.
Certainly. Good morning to you.
Only missed about 10 seconds.
Thank you.
And you can say to my left.
To my left is Representative Pruitt. All right. We're an informal bunch. I plan to continue to run the subcommittee in the same informal manner we have in past years. So everybody's duly warned.
Good on you for that. In any event, we try to provide our services or organize our mission, if you will, around four core areas, which many of you may be familiar with. We're protecting the safety and well-being of Alaskans, obviously. It's of critical importance and consumes about 60% of our budget. Fostering the responsible development of our natural resources is another key component of what we do, and it consumes about 10% of our budget. Protecting the fiscal integrity of the state is another key part of our mission, making sure taxes are paid, royalties are paid, and the leases are settled, and so on. And finally, promoting good governance, which is about approximately 10% of our budget. We presently have 296 attorneys, 278 support staff, and like many departments, personal services has the vast majority of our budget, about 72%. Two areas that I want to just touch on this morning are the resource development and states' rights issues. One point I want to make, which I tried to emphasize when I appeared last week at the Senate State Affairs Committee, which is that Alaska is not alone in this concern in terms of protecting states' rights and federalism, what people refer to encroachment at various times. I mean, there's a number of ways you can refer to it, but many, many states have issues with the federal government, be it immigration, whether it be firearm rights. And Montana's got a case, and they're trying to before the Tenth Circuit right now. We have many lands issues. I 2 weeks ago was at a summit in Oklahoma City that was convened by the Oklahoma Attorney General about federalism and fossil fuels. And there's probably close to 40 states represented there. And seven or eight attorney generals, including myself and a number of deputies. But it was an eye-opener for me to hear other states decry what they perceive to be real substantial issues of federal encroachment, what they do, an imbalance, if you will, between the federal government and the state government. And of course, many lawyers on this panel know that the federal government is one of enumerated powers. States are the balance of powers reserved to the states. Most recently, in the Affordable Care Act litigation, the Supreme Court said that assessing a penalty on people who do not buy insurance, it's mandatory health insurance, it's a key feature of the President's plan, was not permissible under the Commerce Clause. So this doctrine is real, and it's got teeth in the right circumstances. Of course, the penalty in question was upheld under the Congress's taxing power in that particular instance, but nonetheless, there are limits to it in many states. I mean, many states in the Midwest with aging power plants and power generation facilities are being threatened by new regulations. There's cross-state pollution rules that the EPA has tried to enforce that are very onerous. So it's an issue up here, certainly. I want to touch on a few of the areas, but the only point I want to emphasize is that we are not alone in this. I can assure you and as being a member of the National Association of Attorney Generals, I probably see more of it, and we're solicited more to join amicus briefs or intervening cases that may affect our interests. And so I'm surprised at the breadth of this concern across the states and the issues in which are involved. And they're not always our issues, which tend to be lands, but believe me, that this is not an issue that Alaska is isolated about. This is a concern that crosses many states. Endangered species cases, climate change is now the new game changer, if you will, when it comes to Endangered Species Act. And Alaska tends to be in the forefront of that because we have species affected by ice. For example, polar bears and seals and so on that you don't see in some of the other 48 states. But that is coming as well. This climate change and how it impacts species in the lower 48 is I think the next wave of this. And again, that was a subject of some concern at the summit, in which a panel of experts, law professors, academic types, and so on appeared. So, in any event, I just want to make that point. I mentioned endangered species. We do use outside counsel for our endangered species litigation. We're currently involved in cases involving the polar bear listing in Washington, D.C., which is on appeal to the D.C. Circuit. In terms of the critical habitat, the federal district court here in Anchorage, two weeks ago granted the state's motion on summary judgment that the NMFS designation, that's the National Marine Fisheries Service, designation of critical habitat for the polar bear was overly broad, and it was almost 190,000 square miles in the Arctic and offshore, and the effect of those critical habitat is that's essentially to federalize state land, because anything that goes forward then on state lands has to jump through an additional hoop of showing that there's no threat to the species in question, that is either endangered or threatened. So that was a significant win. Of course, I'm sure it's going to be appealed, and that's not yet rested, but the rule's been vacated. So that was significant. It's been vacated and not just remanded. So development can continue to go forward until such time as a new rule that's promulgated that complies with the law. Also, Stellar Sea Lions, we're involved in that litigation. That has a real impact. That's caused jobs in the Aleutians, pollock fisheries, and so on. We lost that case before the district court, but it's on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. It was argued in December, and I'm not going to – I mean, our attorneys were pleased with how it went. I think the science behind that particular decision was very weak. But we have to deal with a deference standard that the courts give to agency determinations, which is difficult to overcome. But as I said, I'm encouraged by that case. But that's another example of endangered species litigation we have going on. The bearded and ringed seal was recently announced is up for a 90-day listing or 90-day review. This is a species in which there are millions, literally millions of species, but based on their 100-year model, 100 years model, because of the loss of sea ice and so on and habitat, they've decided to go through this potential listing process. This is what you think about, how anybody can you do anything but speculate about something that's 100 years out. But this is what we're up against, and there's many NGOs who are aggressively pushing these designations, Center for Biological Diversity, Natural Resource Defense Council, and I don't impugn those groups, but I'm just saying they're aggressive, they're well-funded, and they're pushing these agencies in that direction all the time. So we have a real battle there, and it's not just on the legal front, it's also on the scientific front. We're working closely with Fish and Game because I'd like to think that we could develop our own science. This has been going on for some time. We are developing data and trying to track species and develop a good data on some species that are yet to be listed, the archipelago wolf here in Southeast, some other species. And so one way to fight speculative science is to develop your own good science. to hire our own modeling experts to take a look at some of these issues and to offer some critical comments. So it's not just a legal front, it's a science front as well. And again, we're working with Fish and Game closely on that and have a good cooperative relationship with them. They're very much on board with us. The Tongass is, we have several cases pending with the Tongass, either fighting the roadless rule, which was implemented some time ago. It's actually been enjoined for most of its existence, but the Tenth Circuit recently the roadless rule was not intended to apply to the Tongass. There was a lawsuit by the state years ago and a settlement. And but recently, the Federal District Court in Anchorage, I should say last year, threw that temporary rule out. It had been in effect for many years and said that the roadless rule did apply. So that's on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. We have a case pending in the D.C. relating to the Tongass as well, challenging the roadless rule. The main frustration with the Tongass is that under the Tongass Timber Reform Act, which did away with the several hundred million board feet of timber harvest per year, which used to be the standard up here when we had pulp mills and Ketchikan and Sitka and so on. Now it's to meet annual demand. This Forest Service is supposed to issue such forest sales and have such forest sales and seek to meet annual demand for timber, which is about 125 million board feet. But they've never done that. They've never come close to that. We've looked at that potential cause of action as well. But again, it's just an ongoing issue. We have resources devoted to that. There are a couple cases pending in which we're pursuing. There may be new cases in the future, but it's, as everyone here probably knows, the timber industry is largely dried up, I think, in the base, and Tongass was the driver of that. So, and I emphasize that these are, particularly the subject of the Tongass, this is from a national direction. This is not being critical of the local forester, the local BLM folks, the U.S. Forest Service, who I think have always been sympathetic and proactive with the state, but it's a national direction that's coming down, and I'm not saying it even started with this administration, but it's something that we are finding. We filed a lawsuit last summer on the Mosquito Fork of the 40 Mile River. We're seeking to get an injunction that the state owns the land under that navigable waterway. The feds contend that it's not navigable, that particular stretch of river, about 30 miles, and we disagree. If you look at photographs of it, it looks as navigable as any river I've seen. So, but that's a fight we have started with the feds to try to quiet title to these submerged lands. Navigability issues in general, or the National Park Service, the friction with the Park Service and their enforcement of federal regulations on what we on state lands, which would be against submerged lands under waterways, navigable waterways that run in federal parks. You know, for many years there was a peaceful coexistence, and but in the late 90s they started enforcing their own regulations in those parks and issuing tickets to people for uses, hovercrafts and so on, that they had exercised for many years. And again, why they did it, there was no reports of abuse or anything like that I'm aware of. It's just they're trying to enforce these regulations. There's been a couple of cases of note. The one that we're most significantly involved in involves a fellow by the name of Mr. Sturgeon, who's a constituent of Senator Geisel. And we've joined that case to, again, seek a clarification and determination of our rights that the feds should not enforce those regulations on state waterways and what we contend are state lands. That's in the very early stages of the case. The last two, we have also, and again, I would categorize all these in the nature of issues with the federal government. The Voting Rights Act. We started a lawsuit in August. I authorized the filing of a lawsuit to states to set aside Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Section 5, we're one of 12 states, and how Alaska ever got covered by the Voting Rights Act, such that we have to get pre-clearance to get our elections approved, our redistricting approved, to change precincts, to seek any type of change in our voting procedures is mind-boggling, really. And you know, you can all think about in the 60s, voting discrimination was rampant. It was a national disgrace. It was taking place in southern states where black voters were disenfranchised, and it was a disgrace. And the Voting Rights Act was intended to remedy that. We think it largely has. A witness, you know, the president that we just most recently re-elected for a second term. But efforts to try to resist this and efforts to get Congress to just let this law expire, and because it has to be extended by Congress, which is what the problem has been. Last extension was for 25 years. But it's virtually impossible to get to escape its clutches once you're in it. And so, many of you will recall this last spring when redistricting was going on. Our redistricting board was paying attention and focused on the federal voting issues and maintaining native districts, or what their expert, perceived as a technical term for it, and excuse me, I don't recall it, but the point is that there were these type of issues that were at the forefront. Well, under our state constitution, those aren't permissible. Our state constitution says voting districts will be set by contiguousness, social and cultural characteristics, and so on. And the court, our Supreme Court, threw out the redistricting board's plan because it didn't comply with the state constitution. But the redistricting board says, well, hey, we've got to get this approved by the feds. And so it was, you know, and they were saying, we can't do both things. Well, I don't want to get all the merits of it, but the point is we went through a lot of gyrations, a lot of unnecessary gyrations, only because our redistricting plan had to be pre-approved by the Department of Justice. It's wrong. There's no justification for it. There's a case pending before the U.S. Supreme Court this term that will be argued in March, Shelby County. Shelby County is seeking to do the same thing that we're doing. It's a county in Alabama. And we filed our case. We filed an amicus brief with the Shelby County. Shelby's cert petition was accepted, and so at that time we stayed our case in the district court pending its decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Shelby County case, which we think and we hope may, you know, Shelby County is again seeking to set aside the whole Section 5. Let me make another point of emphasis. Discrimination of voting of any kind will continue to be illegal, both under federal and state law. That's not what this is about. This is simply about the state being caught in the clutches of this preclearance requirement in Section 5, along with 11 other states. And every time we're trying to make a change to our election plans, we have to go through this approval, which is time-consuming and difficult. Yes?
Yeah, are you concerned that Shelby County in Alabama might not be the greatest poster child to reverse the clutches of the Voting Rights Act?
Well, I through the chair, I've heard different things about that, Representative Ledoux. I believe
I don't know anything about Shelby County. I just know Alabama.
Well, your point's worth thinking. I had the same reaction and thought that's why I wanted to start our case, because in my mind, I thought that the Supreme Court might not accept Shelby County as the case because of what you just pointed out. It is one of the original states that where this bad acts gave rise to the Voting Rights Act. On the other hand, so that's why we fought our case, in case Shelby was not accepted, that we would have our case in line and to start litigating and hopefully get it before the court to be heard in the event that, you know, we were not successful below. On the other hand, I heard that that might very well be say poetic justice, but there would be a certain irony if the court did use Shelby County as a vehicle for overturning it, because to show the market change that has occurred in the, it's been 35, 50, almost 50 years since the Voting Rights Act was passed. And so, interesting point. I'm not worried about it, and sure it was accepted. And there was a case in 2009 called the Mundo. It's a Northwest Austin. It's an acronym for a utility district in Texas, which was bound up in the same thing. And the Supreme Court almost threw out Section 5 at that time. They were quite critical of the act, and said that unless it was reauthorized with factual findings by Congress to show that the additional extension of Section 5 was justified, that, I mean, they were came very close. I've read the opinion, and they were quite critical. Well, what did Congress do? They reauthorized it without any findings. So, in any event, they've kind of signaled, they've sent some signal that there, at least there's a number of justices that are feel that this is an act and a remedy that's outlived its usefulness and has outlived the reality of today's society. But in any event, the last one is the emission control area. And I think I've given briefings on that before. The 200-mile ribbon, if you will, it's also called the exclusive economic zone. It's 200 miles from the coast, the southern coast of Alaska, the west coast of Canada, west coast of the U.S., and then it also extends up the east coast, the Gulf of Mexico, and so on. But it's a ribbon of enforcement area, if you will, in which ships sailing in that area will now have to burn low sulfur fuel, which is more expensive than regular diesel fuel, the bunker fuel that they've burned for many, many years. In August 2015, these ships will have to start burning ultra low sulfur fuel, which is even more expensive. 90% of the goods consumed by 85% of all Alaskans go through the Port of Anchorage. Unlike virtually any state where they get their freight from rail or truck and so on, I mean, we get all of our freight through through shipping, virtually all of it. And it sails in that exclusive economic zone. So we contend that it really has a very disproportionate impact on Alaskans. It's going to raise the cost of goods, and there's no environmental or scientific basis to extend the rule to southern Alaska. And when they started this process back in 2009, I mean, they literally said in their notices, proposed what they were doing, that ideally they would like to include Alaska, ideally, and that raises my hackles when I hear a regular talk about it. We'd like to do something ideally. I mean, that's not the test. The test is there an environmental harm there that this proposed rule is going to remedy or benefit? Now, there certainly is in Southern California. The South Coast Air Quality District has joined our lawsuit, or intervened, I should say, in our lawsuit, because they want to uphold this rule. And I don't blame them. If I lived there, I would too. South Coast Air Quality District has 16 million people in it. And cars, I don't know how many millions of cars, and horrible air quality in Southern California. It includes, South Coast Air Quality District includes Long Beach and Los Angeles. So, again, it's an example of the federal government, one size fits all. This works for Southern California, where they got the worst air pollution in the country, and we're going to do the same thing up in Alaska. And we objected, we fought a lawsuit. I was just reading our reply brief on the plane coming up here. We've moved for a preliminary injunction. The briefing will be done in March, and anticipate a ruling sometime probably the second quarter this year. But those are the major cases, and there's less than 10, really, if you look at them all, but in which we're involved in this where we're pushing back, where we think it's appropriate against the federal government. Again, that's something we share with other states as well. And I want to say also it's a nonpartisan thing. Montana is seeking to overturn a law that regulates the intrastate sale and manufacture of firearms. And that was, they're seeking to overturn that law, and we've joined that amicus, filed an amicus brief in that case as well. That's a death started by Democratic Attorney General. He's now the governor of the state of Montana. So,
if I can interrupt you, I think we have a question or comment from Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, I actually want to step back to the ECA. I know we talked a little bit about that. Just to remind me, I know we've focused mostly on the trade aspect, the impact that it'll have on trade to the majority of Alaskans. Is there a conversation or is there an aspect of our loss that also includes the impact on the economics of Southeast, specifically how the cruise ship industry, for example, could be negatively impacted and having fewer people in Southeast and the impact there?
Well, there is an impact, but I'm not sure that we, the state, have not developed that. Okay. Representative, through the chair, we've looked at it, and they have their own counsel. Royal Caribbean entered into its own deal with the EPA.
Okay.
There's been some individual initiatives. Tote is another example in the
right.
Freight. They're going to convert to LNG at the cost of several hundred million dollars, which I think somebody has to pay for at some point. But nonetheless, there's been individual deals. I mean, the EPA, I think, is at least trying to put a face on being, I think they recognize what we're trying to say here. And so they've shown some flexibility, in our view, not enough. But I know we have not addressed the cruise impact in great detail. We have talked about the cost of goods, and we have talked about loss of royalties, because the tankers that ship our hydrocarbons to ports on the West Coast will have to burn this low sulfur fuel. Transportation costs go into what they can deduct from what they otherwise owe the state for royalties. So there's that impact. And the government hired an expert to opine that the impact's minimal, and we've got an expert who says it's more substantial than you believe, and your analysis is flawed. So there's a little bit of that dueling consultants, but there is definitely an impact, whether it's small. And the importance of that is simply to give us standing to attack this rule and to get relief. We have to show standing, and so we believe we have, and the government seems to concede we have. So beyond that, the impact, I think, is debated by both sides. But I'm not familiar that we've done much with the cruise impact per se.
Okay.
I'm not sure. It might be too speculative for us, but I just don't know beyond that.
Okay. And just to kind of follow up on that, I mean, just the impact of potentially $140 per cruise passenger is substantially more than even the $50 head tax that we implemented. Obviously, we reversed an aspect of it, so you could see the drawback in customers when we had our head tax, and now you almost triple that. It's substantial.
It's a concern.
Definitely a concern. I have for the economic reality down here in Southeast.
Well, I share that concern, yeah. Representative. You know, the reality is that these vessels are movable assets.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And you know what there's a big trade obviously down in Mexico and the Caribbean. Well, these ships can leave Long Beach or Los Angeles and just hang a left.
Yeah.
Because there is no ECA in Mexico.
Yeah.
So they can do the cruises. In fact, there's very few ECAs, emission controllers, that have been established anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Is the reality. I think there's one in the Baltic states. I'm not sure the exact contours of it. And there's the US Canada one. But they can just sail left out of Long, and they don't have to burn their regular cheaper fuel, and they don't have to pass on a cost to their customers. So it's an issue. I share your concern. I'm sorry, I don't have additional details.
Oh, that's fine. And just want to follow up. I know when we talked last in December, there was so far there has not been another state that has chosen to join us basically in this. Has there been any movement on that? Is Hawaii or one of the, of course, they, you know, I understand there's some sympathies there between the administrations there, similar in mindset. But have there been other states that have seen some movement on maybe joining us and seeing this issue as impacting them as well?
No. And Hawaii is, I did speak with the Hawaii AG and sent him the complaint, and I've consulted with him, and he's very sympathetic, but there's an economic, there's an emission control area around the Hawaiian Islands. There's 200 miles.
Yeah, yeah.
So ships leave the West Coast once they're in the open ocean, once they're over 2 miles out, they burn regular fuel. They switch back and forth. They have multiple tanks in a vessel. So then they burn the cheaper fuel once they get out the 200-mile limit, and they can burn that cheaper fuel all the way till they're within Hawaii. You see. So it does have an impact on Hawaii, but not nearly like it does on Alaska. And for whatever reasons, you know what, I didn't pry argue with them. They did take a serious look at it, but they've not joined in other states. As I said, a lot of other states are impacted by ship emission. I mean, Alaska is not one of them.
Yeah.
Not one of them. And so we don't quarrel with what they're trying to do. We just don't feel like they've taken into account. You know, we're a republic of 50 states. We should have, and all the states have some uniqueness, and they should take that into account. It's not one size fits all. So, in any event, no other states are viewing.
All right. Appreciate it.
Unless there's other questions on that, I just want to touch. I'm sorry, Representative Greenberg.
Thank you. Mr. Attorney General, first of all, thank you for your presentation. It seems that, and maybe this is just the way you structured your presentation, it seems that this state is going in a direction of increasing litigation with the federal government over states' rights, that this is a trend that is growing in this state. Is that an accurate interpretation of what you're saying?
I wouldn't venture a guess, Representative. Since I've just been here a year, I can't say that I followed it religiously when I was not in the Department of Law. I don't believe there's been an acceleration or a focus on it since I've been Attorney General. I mean, I've looked at all these cases very carefully before we file them, and there's others in which I've said, you know, I don't think we should file. This to me is not a good case. You know, I tried cases in private practice. I was a litigator. It's not making a stand for me or taking a policy decision. It's looking at a case that we can win, and we've got principled, strong arguments that we can make. So I don't believe it is. I can't give you a numerical analysis, but certainly and the only reason I've focused on is because it's something we do that's a little bit outside the ordinary, perhaps what other departments do. But you know, fostering developments for our responsible for our natural resources is still just less than 10% of our budget, so it doesn't begin to compare to what we spend on the criminal district attorneys and law enforcement, and which I want to get to next. But short answer is I don't know that it is. I don't believe it is.
If I may follow up. Having been on this subcommittee for a little while now, it seems that over the last several years, the department has requested more attorneys to deal with this spate of litigation against the federal government. That has seemed to be a trend, and what I'm wondering is of whether the administration has asked the Department of Law to look with particular care or additional scrutiny in this area, whether that is something that our state as a policy matter, not just in the last year, but past that, has there been any internal discussion on a desire to focus in this area?
Well, they have not asked me to focus on that area or to seek more funding for attorneys. I mean, I'm sure you're not asking me for my those discussions I have with the governor or something like that, Representative. But I can tell you without breaching any confidentiality, that's not been a focus with this governor. The new positions in our Department of Law this year are in the criminal section. We have the Child Protection Paralegal in Fairbanks, I believe, is a new position, but otherwise there's no new positions being sought on the civil side in terms of these cases. We've got a big department, and we've got great attorneys, and so as long as I'm Attorney General, we're going to fully utilize the resources that we have, which are superb. And as I said, all the cases I just mentioned to you, the only one that we're using outside counseling is in the Endangered Species Act litigation. Everything else is being done in-house. I'm not seeking any funding for the cases, that just to staff the cases that we've got. I've not been asked to seek staffing to do more federalism cases. I'd have something to say about that if I was. I'm happy to look at new cases and to evaluate new causes of action, but we've got people, great people, and we're, if there's something that's meritorious we should pursue, we'll do it. But no, that's not been a focus.
Thank you, and I'm going to ask a question that is off the subject entirely. I've seen some statistics, and I think probably most of the folks in this room will recall, that the number of attorneys general since statehood has shown most attorneys general don't last very long in the job, and a very high turnover. And I was surprised to see that. I think Ed Boyko lasted a little longer than some of the rest, but I'm not too sure about it. Certainly Bruce Patello did. He's a poster child, I think, for longevity.
Yes,
Also in the mayoral position.
Yes.
We all need to find it in this legislature what's his secret, you know? My question, and this is something I don't really need an answer for right now, but you're uniquely qualified in this room anyway to give us the benefit of your thinking. Why has there been such a turnover? Is it a good thing? Is it not a good thing? And if it's not a good thing, what would you recommend to reverse the trend?
Well, Representative, I don't, obviously have not gone back to talk, canvas former attorney general. I did have a discussion with Charlie Cole, who's an old friend of mine, and Charlie, I think, stayed 3 years. I think the recent turnover has been very individualized to that circumstance. Let me put it this way. I don't think there's anything institutional about the position that's driving people out of it. It's certainly not driving me out of it. I enjoy my job. I enjoy working with the legislature and the administration. It's a very challenging job. I think most attorneys would find it that way if you could afford it. I took this job because of the tail end of my career. So I don't think it's anything institutional. I think I think there's just circumstances. We can all, you know, the failed ratification or failed votes. And some people question choices for personal reasons. I think it's hard to do this job from Fairbanks, and it's hard enough to do from Anchorage. But there's, I think there's things about the job that, but I don't think it's an institutional problem. Let me put it that way. There's nothing.
That was my question.
Yeah, well, I think that's
I know
a fair
people
question.
Are leaving the judiciary, the federal judiciary, the state judiciary. We've seen some good judges leave for economic reasons, I don't need an answer. If you have any suggestions, and I'm obviously not being partisan here.
No, you're not.
Any suggestions you have? Because I think stability and longevity and the benefit of people's experience is very valuable. And if the person just learns where the restroom is and then they're out the door, that ain't necessarily good for the state on a variety of levels.
Well, I absolutely agree. I hope to reverse recent trends. The decision won't be mine all the time, but I do hope to reverse it because I enjoy the job. I find it very challenging. But I certainly agree with your factual observations about recent times, and that's unfortunate. When there's a kind of turnover, it's inefficient, it's difficult for the department, and so many levels. But I don't think it's anything to do with the institution per se. And I look forward to reversing the trend and appearing before you many times.
Madam Chair. Returning to Representative Grunberg's first line of questions, are there instances where the state, and I'd be interested in specifics if you can give them to me, where the state has concluded it won't challenge something? And I say that because I'm a real believer in state sovereignty, but I also believe strongly in Article 5 supremacy. If the United States government wasn't deemed supreme, there wouldn't be any reason for the Union, seems to me. And we could just form 50 nations. are there instances where the AG's office has said, you know, this isn't phony science or bad science. It's legitimate science, and we're not going to challenge something.
Well, the federal government's supreme within its enumerated powers, Representative, and I think that's where the rub is. And we've all seen, I think we would all agree, that over the past 50, 60 years, there's been a real growth in the federal government, the power of the federal government. Now, much of it has been very positive. I don't know where, I mean, the civil rights movement, for instance, got its legs and from the federal government. Federal government's the one that's passed the laws, Civil Rights Act of 64 and so on, Voting Rights Act. Federal government's been very proactive in very, very many positive ways, no question about that. And I wouldn't belabor those issues. But the federalism concern is that where they have the power to set standards for air quality, for example, or in water quality, that the states should be able to come forward, for example, with state implementation plans to seek how they are going to meet those standards in ways that are unique to that state and taking into account that state's special characteristics and the geography or whatever the case may be. So that's an area where, at least as coming from the summit, I mean, many states, the federal government's now coming in with federal implementation plans. They are telling the states how to achieve these standards and ways, again, when you have a one-size-fits-all, it can be costly, inefficient, and it's just kind of, in my mind, always been a remarkable conceit that the federal government, supremacy clause or not, could tell a state government in Honolulu or a state government in Juneau or Montana, this is the best way to do it. This is how you'll do it. I mean, hey, think about it. If somebody in Washington, D.C. is going to tell you how to do that? Now, again, I don't want to get into philosophical discussion here with you, but I think there is a point of view, and you know, within the principles that you're talking about, there's also a balance that's supposed to be struck there. And again, the federal government has been slapped down, most recently in that Affordable Care Act. It's not unlimited, the commerce power. So there are limits to it. And one of the main reasons, I think, if you listen to the oral argument of that case, the Solicitor General could not enunciate a limiting principle to the commerce power. And when he was asked, well, if you can do this, if you can penalize people for not joining us, what can't you do? There was no good answer to that. So I think, anyway, there are limits on it. In terms of specific cases we've turned down, I mean, you know, we've, for example, you know, we've looked at the Tongass Timber Reform Act and the requirement that the federal foresters must seek to meet annual demand, which is 100+ million board feet a year. You know, we've looked at that. Well, is that they haven't done that? I mean, it's in the law. It says they're supposed to do that. But there's many qualifications, there's many conditions attached to it, it's a subject to funding and stuff like that, so there's some gray areas in it, and so we've looked at that, at least for the time being. We've got a couple other cases pending dealing with the Tongass, including an important one for the Ninth Circuit, and you know, I think the decision was made, let's just hold off, let's not, you know, we're not, this is a case you could file, but and it's not a science-based issue, it's more just a policy. Good judgment, in my view. Let's keep our powder dry, and we've got other things going on. So, there could be other examples. They may not reach my level. I mean, I don't have people running around looking to, you know, for plausible federal lawsuits. And so, if the science is good, it could have been a rule that we supported. I mean, if the science is good and there's a benefit to the state, we don't necessarily fight all that stuff. So, it could be something that we've actually joined. Filed comments in support of, conceivably. So certainly there's good science. I don't disagree with that. Certainly there's beneficial federal action. They have a role to play, an important role. And you know, it's not a philosophical thing with me. It's more just looking at the equities of the situation. I think this is not right. Okay. So I hope that's responsive to your question.
No, it is. Thank you. I appreciate the concrete example. That's what I...
Well, and it may not be exactly on point, but I did give
no,
you an
is.
Example.
Thank you.
Anything else? The only thing I want to touch on, because I've got others, I'm sure the committee's got things to do, and I don't know how much time we have, Madam Chair.
I think we have until noon.
Well, let me just touch on, to get away from these other issues, which can be controversial. I mean, I spent yesterday about 5 hours in the chairing the task force on sexual and human trafficking and promoting prostitution, which this legislature passed a bill last year criminalizing various aspects of trafficking. We've had public hearings in Bethel, Anchorage, Hooper Bay, and been around the state, and we're now working on recommendations. And our report will be filed later in February, mid-month. But, you know, it is, I'm not going to say it's a burning problem in the state, but it is a problem. When I went into this, I wouldn't say skeptical, but I guess I was ignorant about it. And, but it is out there. And I think the legislature was wise to pass some laws dealing with it. I think there's going to be some amendments. We're trying to tweak that some more. We're going to come up with a series of recommendations on that. We are doing very involved in SART training, sexual assault response team, and trying to develop that. You know, domestic violence and sexual assault is a scourge in the state. It's an epidemic. We as a society should be ashamed of it. I applaud the governor for tackling what is a very, very difficult topic, a very, very difficult subject. Something's been swept in the corners, I think, of our society, our communities, for many years. He's shed light on it, and he's got an absolutely sincere and laser-like focus on doing something to remedy it. And I've been privileged to work with him on that and to serve in this task force. And we as a department, as I said, there's new positions this year in Bethel, Juneau, and Fairbanks, the communities where additional help is needed, and as I said, that consumes the biggest part of our budget, but you know, for good reason. So child advocacy training, something else, training is so important in trying to get at the root of some of these problems. Victims of trafficking are generally very reluctant to participate. They've either been coerced or threatened to be in the trade, and it's difficult to solicit their cooperation. So there's agencies out there that we're working with and trying to work with and to cross-train each other to better deal with that. So it's something that I'm proud to be associated with, and you know, we're looking to prosecute people who are engaged in it. It's a modern form of slavery, and we need to do something about it. So with that, unless there's additional questions, I wanted to
I appreciate the last sentence you said, which I'd like to focus on. It's a type of slavery. There are other types of slavery also, economic slavery, everything from farm workers on down. And I was reading something just a day or two ago where they said basically something else was a form of slavery. Are you looking into other types of economic situations? I don't have anything particularly in mind. This just happens to be one that's getting the headlines now. But there are others out there that are no less pernicious.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, the human trafficking, I think, is the broad umbrella that we would include people who, dancers, for example. There's been examples of dancers come over here from another country, and it's supposed to be a cultural exchange trip or something, and they're tricked into a type of is economic slavery. I think it's also the potential there is in fisheries, people coming from the Philippines or other countries where the labor costs are cheap. So I think there are other examples. It's just as illegal, it's just as pernicious. I agree with you 100%. So we're not turning our back on any of it. It's all important, and if we're brought evidence, I mean, I want to be quite aggressive in going after all these things. We've been given new tools by the legislature, and we need to use those tools. So I don't think it exists here, for example, as it does in California, Washington. So keeping that in mind, we have a big state, and there's a lot of area to cover, and communities are very remote, and law enforcement is not present in every single community. So, you know, there's difficulties with it, but if there's evidence of it, it's brought to our attention, we'll go after and investigate it, no question about it. But because I do agree with you, it's not.
I had nothing specific in mind.
No, no.
Just your sentence jogged my memory.
Absolutely. I'm representative, and I agree with you on that.
Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair.
If there's nothing else, then I was going to introduce my deputy in charge of criminal, Rick Svobodny, to talk a little bit about in more detail what they do and maybe present some information.
Absolutely. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This was a planned segue, Attorney General talking about domestic violence and sexual assault. To me, the criminal division, the Department of Law, is going to be the division that has some incremental requests for you this session. So let me just kind of fill in a little bit more about the governor's initiative on sexual assault, against sexual assault, domestic violence, human trafficking, because that, as I said, is where the increments are this year. The Attorney General was very modest in talking about just yesterday chairing the committee, the task force on human trafficking. The governor is so focused on this that he has the Attorney General and me in weekly meetings dealing with the domestic violence issues, and then the next week it'll be with sexual assault issues, and where are you as far as policies and procedures, and how do you know that your people are following those policies and procedures. So there's is a very focused response that the governor's has towards dealing with this problem. It's a little bit out of my comfort zone as a prosecutor, not the issue of dealing with the prosecution of these cases, but really the issues, the way we're going to solve the epidemic of domestic violence, sexual assault, sexual abuse of children is changing the culture. That's different than going to court, and it's a little bit harder. So I just want to, it's a lot harder. So let me just kind of go over some of the things that are generally beyond the comfort zone of the 94 prosecutors that we have in this state. We've been trying to take the lead in making sure that there are standards for sexual assault examinations. Department of Public Safety is dealing with sexual assault kits, and we're advising them on those things, including the payment for to making sure that any victim of a sexual assault who needs a forensic examination is getting it, and even if they can't afford it, the Department of Public Safety is covering that. We, the criminal division, are. Yes,
well, when you use the phrase "even if they can't afford it," suggests that those who can afford it are supposed to be doing the division's investigation. I mean, I don't understand that. It just seems like a regular criminal thing, and even if somebody could afford to do it themselves, that you'd still do it.
Through the chair, it's a good clarification. Under a law that you passed in the 80s, a long time ago, those examinations, if done, are not to be used to, how to say this, as an incentive for the victim of a crime to go forward with the prosecution. The police aren't saying, we'll go through, we'll have you have this examination, which has some forensic purposes for us, but also has good medical reasons for you to do. They can't use, and they aren't using, those examinations as some as a reward or a that's a terrible word to use in this circumstance, as a way of trying to convince somebody to go forward with a prosecution. And that's what I meant with without affording it. There's no income-based determination. Those examinations are requested sometimes by the police, and the police pay for it. They're sometimes requested by the victim of a crime or an advocate for a sexual assault, and basically public safety pays for them. So I'm sorry if I wasn't articulate enough. There is no needs test.
Okay.
I told you it was out of our comfort zone.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You meant that income shouldn't be a barrier to getting the test, right. Not that people who could afford it had to pay. Yeah. Good clarification.
Thank you, Chair. We've also been involved substantially this last year in child advocacy centers, where we want to make sure that there's as few interviews of children as possible. And so law enforcement either are trained specifically in how to deal with children and do an interview at a child appropriate facility, someplace that's not like in a squad room in a police station, but at a facility where, you know, there's children-sized furniture, there are things that interest children. And so we've been involved in both dealing with training of the police, and then sometimes, you know, they just can't do an interview with a four-year-old very well. And so if they can't, and they know those restrictions, child advocacy centers have hired forensic interviewers, and with the police in the background, the forensic interviewers do the interviews with the kids. But that's something else that the Department of Law has been involved.
And if I may interrupt, if there's anyone here who hasn't had a chance to tour one of those centers, they're very impressive, very, very child-friendly, very trying to minimize the trauma to the child. So recommend it to anybody.
And Madam Chair, there's one here that I'm sure if anybody during this session wanted to look at, we could arrange a tour. We've also been instrumental in figuring out that, you know, we have a different population than we had 20 years ago or 50 years ago, and a lot of people aren't proficient in the English language. So we have been working with the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., kind of as establishing a model of how to deal with we're dealing with victims and witnesses who aren't English proficient, but ultimately would be able to be used by other departments, and how to deal with that. Having said, so that's kind of the transition. Just for some of you who may not know, the Criminal Division of the Department of Law has 13 offices across the state. We have 94 prosecutors in those offices. They vary from a lawyer office in Sitka to a 35 lawyer office in Anchorage. When I started, there were four offices that just had one attorney in them, and if I may, Madam Chair, to respond to Representative Grunberg on an assistant DA level. That's one way we're keeping people. When you have somebody you can, you know, walk out of your office and walk into their office and talk about a case, that's one way that we've focused on dealing with retention of people, especially in rural areas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Svobodny, I worked in your division for a couple of years.
In one of those offices that we've
right.
Our lawyers in.
Are the Dillingham and Kotzebue offices still manned by one prosecutor?
Through the chair. No, that was the point I was trying to make.
Okay.
I didn't name the offices, but let me. Barrow used to have one. Now we have two. At no, may I say, additional expense to the state of Alaska, the North Slope Borough. We created the PCN. They're paying for the funding. Billingham, again, through no creation of a new PCN or really funding, we were able to reclassify a paralegal and put a second DA in Dillingham. In Kotzebue, the legislature last year added another lawyer to the Kotzebue office. So the only one left is Sitka, and the caseload really doesn't justify having two people there. And Sitka's 90 miles away, that lawyer gets to Juneau enough that she can have that collegiality in talking about cases.
Well, if I could just a comment, yeah, on that. I'm delighted to hear that, because I was in Kotzebue for 2 years and never took any leave. I was told I could clear the calendar, but that was sort of a laughable proposition. And we were working on 800 cases a year, and it was about a 75-hour-a-week work week. So I'm glad to hear that. I think your department, and I bet this is still true, could be more bold about saying we need substantially more help. And other departments, whenever I see something like this that I know firsthand, I just think it's absurd to have people working those kinds of hours.
If I may, just one other thing that we have done since we left the Department of Law is we have a specialized unit in our Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals, Rural Prosecution Unit, whose its design is to allow people who, in the 2-3 people office, to take a break and send somebody out there. And Kotzebue is one of the places that we have spent a lot of time to give, when it was just a one-lawyer office, mm-hmm, to give the lawyer an opportunity to take breaks. That it has been a big problem with us, and we've recognized it, and over the years took us till after you left to be able to come up with a couple different solutions.
Thank you.
And for those who are new to the committee, this is been a constant topic. This is my seventh year now on this committee, and it's been a morale in the ranks has been a constant discussion back and forth, and they have excellent attorneys throughout the Attorney General's office on both civil and criminal, and trying to figure out how to keep and support them, especially in a cost effective manner, has been a consistent team effort between this committee and the department. So I definitely appreciate your input at all times, having been in the ranks.
If I may, Madam Chair, I'm going to switch focus a little bit, but I mean, you know, these are all tied together. But specifically, what the agenda was today was to deal with measures and to deal with the 10-year projections. So let me kind of move there, and we'll weave back and forth between sexual assault and these numbers. The Department of Law is a very small department of state government. If you look at the budgets of the other departments, we are 1.3% of that. We are the fourth smallest department in state government. The governor's office is the smallest, followed by Military and Veterans Affairs and Environmental Conservation, and then the Department of Law. We have a total budget of $96 million each year. And if you look at our 10-year plan, and that was specifically, I think, what the agenda for today dealt with. If you look at that plan, we are projected out in the next 10 years with a little, you've made two assumptions, an 8% and a 6.5% growth rate. But if you look at our the charts for the Department of Law, you can see we're pretty much flat as we go out for that 10 years in our plan. And I think the numbers that I'm going to give you in a minute, there's a small growth rate over that 10 years, but I think that the numbers that I'm about to give you in a moment will reflect why that is. And it also, so I want to make 2 points about the 10-year plan. One, I think we're on track for what our numbers show has happened in the past, that we're pretty level out there for the 10 years. We don't have any big growth in the next 10 years. The other thing I want to make is with that is, now we are a reactive agency, and it is hard to measure what we do, and I'll give you specific examples as we go over that. But let me just, I don't know if Ms. Abbott gave you the bar graphs for just the last 5 years. Yes, Madam Chairman.
Should have them on
if,
our desk.
If you look at that.
And if I may interrupt, the legislative finance, the 10-year projections and the different graphs that Rick was mentioning should be presented to us by legislative finance this Thursday. So we'll
oh,
get to,
I'm ahead, gonna, we're ahead?
They're gonna, you are ahead of the game. So they're gonna have, you'll have copies of those, but probably hopefully tomorrow for Thursday's meeting.
Well, I'm sorry about that because I don't want to talk about numbers all the time. let me just kind of give you kind of where we are in the criminal division as far as.
Well, they are. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. Which tab? Sorry, Chris.
It's right after the. It's in the introductory part. It's right after.
We do have those.
What I was.
Right after page 21.
After page 21, I don't know where page. Oh, there we go. Plans. All right. We do have.
So as you look at that, okay. You can see that actually we're talking about felony and misdemeanor mm-hmm. cases, and I'm not speaking for the civil division here, but our growth rate is pretty flat. And as you look at the bar graph that I did of felony cases and misdemeanor cases, you'll see that that's pretty much where we have been for the last 5 years. That was the first point that I wanted to make. We are within kind of what we project the numbers to be for growth in the Department of Law for the next 10 years. Now I want to turn to how we measure these things. It's easy to come before you and tell you that last year we roughly had 8,000 felony cases. We had 8,095. We had 21,425 misdemeanors and other matters, and I'll explain what that means in a minute, about 9,500 for a total of 39,000 cases. Okay?
I'm going to interrupt you for just a second. Representative Ledoux.
So I was wondering, the population in 5 years has increased in Alaska. Why do you think that the rate of felonies has gone? Has the actual rate of crimes gone down, or just the ones that you've that the police have caught and you're able to prosecute? I mean, has it gone down but has stayed flat when the population has risen?
Through the chair, we can measure it, but what does it mean is a very difficult question for us. You're right. The population of the state has gone up in the last 5 years. Nationwide, crime has been flat for the last 5 years, and that's also what our numbers have shown. If you go back to 2000, to the year 2000, you will see, and these graphs just show the last 5 years. If you look at a bigger picture from 2000 to 2012, the amount of overall crimes in this state has roughly grown, felony crimes has grown about 60%, from around 5,000 to around 8,000. So I'm giving you two snapshots, one from 2000 and to now. And I think that's also a national trend. People, some experts think that this plateau that we've been at for the last several years is going to change, but it kind of defies common wisdom. When you're in a recession, people generally think that there's going to be more crime, and so criminologists have been very surprised. And I think it goes to prove my point. We can measure certain things like the number of cases, but why it happened, it's just guesswork. So that's part of your question. The other part is, what do these numbers actually mean? And these are cases that the Department of Law, the district attorneys have had to deal with. So they're cases that are actually either referred, and those come from police, and those will be the felonies and the misdemeanors. And then the last graph, other matters, those are most often either self-generated, we've done it ourselves, like a petition to revoke probation, somebody who's been convicted of a crime on probation and they mess up, we bring that back to court, or an extradition where we're trying to bring somebody back from another state to the state of Alaska, or appeals. Juvenile cases are a little bit different in there, but those are what's covered in other matters, and those are sometimes generated by the lawyers, whereas the felonies and misdemeanors are the cases that come to us. And it may be police are doing less investigation, maybe that they're doing better investigation and clearing them out before they come to a DA. That's our problem with measures and measuring matters and what they mean, because we don't. What I can tell you is, these are the cases that came in the door where we had to do something on. So the reason for it is my problem with what we measure. So,
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been, and my office has been, looking at something else the last few weeks, and that is the impact of the aging of the population. My recollection seems to be that as the population ages, the aging population commits fewer crimes, maybe with the exception of some traffic offenses. But leaving those aside, I saw a 100-year-old person just got their license renewed somewhere, which will let pass. Do you think it might be, to some extent, due to the fact I think our population is aging around here a little bit?
Through the chair, yes. I mean, I think that. I mean, you can actually pick crimes. Robberies are committed, by 18. Like about 25-year-olds, drug cases, you're there 18 to maybe 35 years old. Unfortunately, some of the sexual abuse cases, they run the gamut to the 70-year-olds who are out there committing them. But in general, that's a correct statement. As people grow older, I don't know, for the men, maybe it's the testosterone level, and maybe for the those are all speculations.
I think there's someone brain development and stuff
like
that.
It could be that too, yes.
And of course, you put your finger on it. It's difficult to measure, but as policymakers, we pass these criminal laws with the idea that we're protecting the public. And so trying to get a handle on, are we accomplishing that goal? Are we as policymakers, are you as prosecutors, are we making people safer, is always something that we're trying to get our hands around and make sure that we're actually moving in the right direction on that.
I think, in part, part of the criminal justice problems in Alaska have dealt with people outside the urban areas. I mean, those urban areas are pretty pretty much the same as an urban area outside of the state. But as you have funded the additional VPSOs in the village, people are at least saying, and I think they're saying it because it's true, are feeling safer. Just the presence of the people in those villages are making people feel safe. Mm-hmm. So it's hard, but that again, I don't know if that's a 7 on a 10-point scale or a 5. You know,
it's hard to say prosecutions go up, and does that mean that there's more crime, or does that mean that we're getting better at catching it? People feel like they can report it. You know, it's taking these raw numbers and turning it into what does this mean in terms of safety of the public is not a straight forward.
And that was my final point on this, Madam Chair, if I may. I can't tell you between 2012 and between 2011 and 2012 whether it's good or bad that there were 504 more felonies given to us for prosecution. I don't know. That may be that we're doing better police work. It may be that our corrections programs are not doing as well, and more people recidivated. Just those numbers are, I think we can track numbers easily, but what they mean is difficult to say. You know, and I guess that was the second point that I wanted to make.
Representative Ledoux, then.
Just a comment here. In some cases, it might even mean that the legislature has felonized something that previously wasn't a felony.
And does that make people safer or not safer? Who knows?
Yes. I think we have 10 minutes for Mr. Cantor to move on.
Sure. Representative Jefferson.
Thank you. Do these numbers reflect disposition or charge?
The felonies and the misdemeanors,
yeah,
means represent cases referred, because as it's referred, it needs to be screened.
Sure.
Whether it needs to be decided, is there a crime here? Is there sufficient evidence for there to be a crime? They're cases that are opened and take up lawyers' time.
Okay. But this is the, it sounds like this is the original charge. It's not how it was disposed.
That's correct. Yes, sir.
Okay. I mean, because, a person could steal a $500 television, and that's a felony, but it's rarely charged ultimately that way. And so that's also, I mean, you could have a police force that says, we're going to go to the hilt on this and do the maximum charge, and others might say, well, it's not going to be pled that way anyway, so we won't do that. But anyway.
That's correct.
Okay. Any other questions before we let them go? All right. Thank you. Come on up.
Madam Chair, Jim Cantor. I'm the deputy for the Civil Division. And cut me off anytime. We can continue this on Thursday, so I'm not dying to speak.
See how far we can get.
Yeah. Carrying on with Mr. Svobodny's discussion of the missions and measures, which is, I guess, the focus for today, is there are ways that the Department of Law does measure, but again, I'm not sure they're good measures. We measure the amount of money, our overall return on investment. It's about a $100 million department. In FY11, we returned $146 million that we brought in. In FY12, we returned $99.5 million. That has to do with kind of the inaccuracies of when cases resolve. And a case can get started and run for 5 years, and you just get lucky that it resolves in 1 year and not another year. At one point, we put together a graph of like 10 years. Suck in some particularly hot year in order to show how good we did, but in FY13, which has just started, we had the BP corrosion settlement. This case been running for quite a few years, and we had to do a 2006 spills on the North Slope, and we've already brought in $255 million, so we'll put that on next year's graph. There's other areas where we we can measure and show that we've really done a good job, that the measurements show something. In 2002, I believe, the legislature transferred the collections of restitution judgments from the court system to the Department of Law. And what we do is, when the court system orders that the victim of a crime is due restitution, we help collect that sum, primarily through the permanent fund garnishment process. It came to Department of Law. We were doing it with existing resources, and the task was growing. When I started 2 years ago, we had a buildup of 2,900 cases that were just stacked up. We hadn't even opened them. People weren't getting paid. So we threw resources at that. We just internally rearranged. We were able to get some temporary clerical employees, we've got that number down to 350. And apparently those are the gnarly ones that are starting to take time. That's a measure that, as a manager, is meaningful to me. But really what Department of Law does mostly are non-monetary, sometimes non-measurable. Our Child Protection Division, we've got 26 lawyers doing that. It's key to the state of Alaska, but it's a harder one to measure. It is one that this year we're looking for an increment to add a paralegal to our Fairbanks office, where we've got lawyers doing the paralegal and secretarial tasks, as you've probably experienced in Kotzebue. Our tort section is a defense section. People sue us, and we're really proud of the verdicts that we get. We hold them down. We reach good settlements. We'll take cases to trial, but it's hard to measure because it's externally driven. We've got other areas like advice on a contract. Who knows whether we are successful or not? We like to think we're very good at it.
Like what?
I said we like to think we're very good at it.
Advice on contracts.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
As a contract attorney, I always like to think that I helped. Who knows?
I'll just give three examples of different kinds of cases we deal with, mm-hmm. and then we can pick up later on Thursday or answer questions. But yesterday we won a case. To me, it was kind of a loss. It was a dispute between Ketchikan Gateway Borough and the state of Alaska, where somebody had they failed to make their payments on a contract to buy land from the state. They'd also failed to pay their taxes to the Ketchikan Gateway Borough. And there were questions of lien priority. Ultimately, it came down to a lawsuit, and we prevailed. It's kind of a waste of bureaucratic time. It's one that I wish we had been able to settle, and we put a lot of effort into trying to settle it in advance. But still, we had good lawyers on it, and they did a good job, and we prevailed. So that could check off on the positive side. And on the other side, Commissioner Sullivan presented recently on a case.
Yeah. Representative Ledoux on that question.
Yeah, a case involving lien priority actually went to trial rather than being resolved on summary judgment.
Summary judgment. Yes.
What was
summary
judgment? Makes more sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Good question.
a case when the big Gulf of Mexico spill occurred. Secretary Salazar went on national news and said, "I'm putting a moratorium on oil exploration everywhere, including the Arctic." And we said, "Wait a minute, you can't just do that. There's laws. There's processes." So we filed a lawsuit on that one. And what happened is that ultimately the federal government said, "There really wasn't a moratorium." He just said that. And so we lost the case, of course, but we won the principle. We got exploration continuing. Another case, following up on your question of cases that we evaluate and don't take, is the beluga whale listing in Cook Inlet. That was a case where when it was listed, it appeared we had good reason to challenge it. We were ultimately defeated in the district court in D.C. The judge wrote a strong opinion, and tying that to the subsequent science that through those intervening years had come out, the numbers hadn't really increased. and we said, this isn't a case we should appeal. Now, we, you know, the political arm, the governor's office, made us really look at that closely because they want to make sure we're making good legal decisions. Ultimately, we said, this is a good legal decision, and they said, fine. And we did not appeal that.
Thank you.
And there's you know, there's a host of cases where we're on the side of the federal government. There's a case involving Apache, which is doing exploration for oil and gas and Cook Inlet and seismic testing. There's been a challenge relating to the Endangered Species Act. Federal government issued a permit, and we're out there defending that federal permit. So it really is a complicated tapestry.
I think we're probably at a good stopping point, and we're right up. Are you available to join us on Thursday?
I am.
Are you?
Yeah.
I think at our next meeting, we were planning to hear from legislative or finance, from Kelly Cunningham with legislative finance, although I don't think that will take anywhere near the whole time. So we would love to have you join us and continue this on Thursday. Our next meeting will be Thursday in this room at the same time, and I made a critical oversight and did not introduce our committee aide, Grace Abbott, over here, for those of you who don't know. Any questions from the department or members, she's your girl. So, is there anything else before we wrap this up? No? Well, thank you very much to all three of you, for everybody for coming, and we'll see you on Thursday.
Thank you.
Turn. Yep.